This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Ronan Farrow shared a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting for The New Yorker on Harvey Weinstein. His work since then has fueled the Me Too movement with revelation after revelation of misconduct by some very powerful men, particularly in the media. This reporting has been, for so many, wrenching and enraging to read. But there's reason to hope that Farrow's reporting is helping to change the status quo in some very real ways. His book, Catch and Kill, which was just published, has caused an uproar. Among other things, the book details how Harvey Weinstein hired a mysterious organization called Black Cube to try to protect himself. So, Ronan, what is Black Cube? Black Cube sounds like something in the worst kind of spy novel or spy movie you've ever seen, but it's a real thing. Who were they, and why were they hired to follow you?
Black Cube is an Israeli private intelligence firm with very close and very blurry ties to the current active Mossad and Israeli military and other factions of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of business with the Israeli government, but they are a private entity staffed by what they describe as elite operatives skilled in undercover operations, in deception, in using false identities and front companies. And to your point about it sounding like it's from some kind of a hard-boiled spy thriller, when I presented the documentation showing that this had really happened, that there was an international espionage operation around reporters and alleged victims of Harvey Weinstein. If I recall, your reaction and
I
that of
I thought you
other...
were out of your mind.
Yeah.
I thought you were getting a little too tired, maybe a little delusional.
I had the same thought. I mean, who could believe such a thing?
Yeah, and by the way, it's a private business, am I right?
It's a private business. It has government contracts. It touts the fact that it is staffed by alumni of the Mossad and other Israeli intelligence agencies, but it is private. Ehud Barak gave Harvey Weinstein,
former prime minister,
the hot tip that if he had a problem, Black Cube was a great way for him to address it. And Ehud Barak has confirmed that this is the case, but also said he didn't know what it was going to be used for, et cetera, et cetera. But it does go to show the close ties between the Israeli government and Black Cube.
How did you learn about Black Cube? And maybe even more interesting, how did you know you were getting surveilled by Black Cube?
So I first learned about Black Cube because I was getting all sorts of strange calls, and sources were getting all sorts of strange calls. And this was a period in my life where I was looking over my shoulder a lot. I was wondering, as you said, if I was just tired and going a little crazy. The walls were kind of closing in on me in several different ways, and I was stressed, and I was pushing out of my head these concerns that I was seeing the same car over and over again, seeing the same people over and over again.
And just to be clear, this is before publishing even your first article?
Correct. Right. This is over the course of the summer of 2017, mm-hmm. as I'm working on this story, and the story is embattled in various ways, and before I meet you and bring it to the wonderful offices of The New Yorker. Essentially, I then was able to reverse engineer this trail of clues.
Who is Igor Ostrovsky, who plays a role in your book?
So all of these suspicions that I had been surveilled were initially denied outright by Black Cube. They denied they had any contact with reporters. They denied that they had any contact with accusers. And first, a source called Sleeper, who came our way during the reporting of our New Yorker stories, I know this sounds stranger than fiction, but you'll recall, began dropping us documents from inside the Black Cube operation. And that helped us expose the fact that, yes, they had done both. They had sent undercover operatives to, by way of example, become Rose McGowan's best friend and secretly record her.
But this is somebody growing a conscience inside of Black Cube?
Yes. Sleeper is one of the many examples, I'm glad to say, in this book where it's not just about darkness and crime and cover-ups. It's about really brave people putting their jobs and maybe more on the line to try to out the truth. So we were able to get the contracts and documents showing there was an operation. What I still didn't have, David, was proof that I wasn't going crazy and I had been followed. And it was only in 2018 that I got a call from this additional source.
This is Igor Ostrovsky.
That's right. For a podcast to accompany this book that's coming out soon, I sat down with him and heard him out on that.
Well, I was born in Ukraine. And when I was 9, almost 10, we came to Brooklyn. I went to school. I couldn't speak English, but I picked it up pretty quickly in a couple of years. So I take this class in high school, a criminal justice class, and there I made a friend. His uncle had a private investigation company. We ended up being next to that company by accident. He said, "Let's go inside, say hi." I go inside, and as soon as we left, I said to my friend, I said, "Look, Ben, I want a job with your uncle." 4 years later, they did hire me.
So tell me about the first jobs that seemed to be about what you ultimately learned is the Harvey Weinstein case.
Right. So one day I get a call like, "Hey, we got a job tomorrow in Brooklyn, gotta go." And it's a New York Times reporter. And I'm like, "All right, that's weird."
So this is Jodi Kantor.
Yep. And he tells me the name and I think, "Oh, it's a woman. Maybe her husband wants her followed." So we followed Jodi to the New York Times building. We're going to wait to see if she leaves. And if she leaves, we have to figure out who she's meeting with. So if she meets with anyone, we got to follow that person and figure out who they are. And now I understand that this is clearly to figure out who her source is. And I said, "All right, I'm going to keep going along with this, but I'm having issues."
Tell me about those issues. So you're now aware, or at least suspect, that you're being asked to track a reporter to uncover what she's reporting on or how she's reporting on it. How does that make you feel?
Not happy. And especially a publication that I respect.
Pretty rapidly, you guys give up on the Times, right?
Yeah, for some reason, I mean, we were up on Jodi Kantor, I think, 2 times, and the third time, from there, they had me split and go over to your house.
So you guys are staking me out, and what are you told that you're looking for?
Well, same idea, right? So the goal was the same as with Jodi Kantor, to figure out who you're meeting with, just report back your activities. But the main idea is the sources, right? At this point, I was already like, "All right, we got to figure out what's going on, because might have to take some actions, because it looks like something I believe in is being possibly attacked."
So it sounds like the next moment where you kind of learn more about what was really happening here is when I publish that article about Harvey Weinstein's army of spies, and I reveal that he had retained this firm, Black Cube, out of Israel, which had targeted journalists and sources talking to them.
Right, so when I saw that, I said, "Okay, but this is clear who we're working for. And this is clear that this is what they were trying to do, because this is like the story about us without mentioning our tactics or our names directly."
Because the targets that I described in that article were also your targets.
Right. You know, the media is now here being directly attacked, and they're trying to manipulate the reporting. Well, I came from a place where there was no press. There was press that was owned by the government. They reported for the government. It was 100% the agenda of the government that was being shown, and all the people had no other source of information, so they couldn't verify anything. So the government had complete control of the population. And in America, we tend to believe that if you give up an inch, you're giving up a yard, and you're giving up everything. I thought that if I allow this to happen and I walk away and I don't do anything, then I'm complicit in allowing the media, the way of life I believe in, to be attacked and to be changed, and that could be irreversible.
So, Ronan, that was Igor Ostrovsky, who was a subcontractor for Black Cube during that period, and we now know that Black Cube was selling that information about sources, about where you might place that story after NBC killed it, to, of all people, Harvey Weinstein, who was then using it to bully outlets and survivors and reporters. But, you know, I've got to say, he never called me until after The New Yorker started fact-checking, which is very strange, and that comes very late in our process.
I actually think that makes sense with the timeline that I've unraveled in this book. Harvey Weinstein was very busy, as it turns out, making calls to leadership at NBC News, which is where this reporting that I was doing began, and made a desperate bid to discover where I had taken the story, and only really did discover very late in the game. Despite chasing me
around.
So Black
Cube wasn't very good at what they did.
In this instance, they really failed. There's actually a moment in the book, David, where they spend days following a neighbor of mine who looks like me. And they, you know, get up within touching distance of this neighbor of mine and then realize, this isn't him.
Did you ever really fear for your physical self?
To be completely honest, they did freak me out. And I did feel the weight of that surveillance campaign. And
how so?
Well, you'll recall as I was reporting this story, you know, I had conversations with my editor on some of this reporting, David Rode.
Yeah, you weren't eating very well and you weren't sleeping very well. That I remember very distinctly. That,
it's true.
It
and
was
there,
really worrying.
There were nights where, you know, I had been told by sources to get a gun. I had moved out of my apartment
did
and
you
into
get a
friend's
gun?
Place. I do a little target practice in this book. I'll leave it at that. And, you know, I was in a very unsettled place. You know, I felt embattled in a way that when I tell this story in the book, I hope it's not, oh, woe is me, because this is not being a journalist in Pakistan, being a journalist in Russia. You know, I'm not winding up dead the next day. But it is a set of intimidation tactics that shouldn't be thrown at reporters in a country with the First Amendment.
So Black Cube is just one of the tactics employed by Harvey Weinstein to keep his accusers quiet, intimidated. What were some of the others?
Harvey Weinstein hired a number of private investigation firms to dig up dirt on accusers and reporters pursuing this story. He leveraged a wide network of media contacts that included the tabloid outlet, The National Enquirer. AMI had a deal with him. AMI is the publisher of The National Enquirer. He, over the course of my reporting, became closer and closer to Dylan Howard, who's the editor of The National Enquirer. We were later able to break the story that Dylan Howard had been secretly making recordings to try to dig up dirt on Harvey Weinstein's accusers, and had used The Enquirer to try to generate negative items about Harvey Weinstein's enemies. Harvey Weinstein laid siege to even mainstream outlets. There's reporting in this book about the way in which he called again and again the executives of NBC News and extracted from them promises about what was going to happen to the reporting.
Well, I was just going to say, many stories get killed for many reasons, but you're saying that when NBC killed the Weinstein story, that was an entirely different matter.
The reporting suggests that this is something very different. They didn't sit on it too long. They didn't show insufficient interest. They ordered a stop. And the reporting in this book, I think, gives a pretty good sense why.
Why did they step away?
They had, according to Harvey Weinstein, cut a deal. Harvey Weinstein, in his legal threat letters to me and later to The New Yorker, alludes to written assurances from NBC News that they would kill the story and assert a copyright claim if I took the material anywhere else.
Why would NBC make that deal?
Well, so the reporting in this book suggests that during this time frame, when Harvey Weinstein was bearing down on them with a whole lot of threats and enticements, their secrets were under threat of exposure. I referred to this pattern of secret settlements, to the fact that several of those settlements were with women who had complaints and had voiced those complaints within the company about Matt Lauer. And you have Dylan Howard working closely with Harvey Weinstein, pulling files of dirt within the Enquirer about Matt Lauer in this time frame, running in the pages of the Enquirer. This is not speculative. These are articles that actually ran, more and more items about allegations of misconduct in the office by Matt Lauer and NBC leadership being fed up with it. This was all bearing down on this network as Harvey Weinstein approached them with his threats.
So what you're suggesting is that Weinstein, with the help of the National Enquirer, was threatening to expose NBC's problems with Matt Lauer unless they killed the story. Was NBC blackmailed?
You know, the book in this matter and in all other matters is very, very careful and measured. And so it doesn't lay out, a portrayal of a mustache-twirling backroom deal signed in blood. What it does lay out is transcripts and records of phone calls where these executives were backed into a corner and promised they would make the story go away.
Well, let's talk about Dylan Howard, who was the editor of the National Enquirer and who used his position to collaborate with Harvey Weinstein. But Weinstein isn't the only guy that Dylan Howard worked with. He also, you found, collaborated closely with the Donald Trump presidential campaign.
Obviously, we reported several stories about how Donald Trump worked with the National Enquirer during the election. And they later, even though they lied to us when we reported those stories and denied it all, admitted to all this in a non-prosecution agreement with federal prosecutors. There's new information in Catch and Kill about just how deep that collaboration ran. It's the first time a reporter has seen the complete content list of all the dirt that the National Enquirer had on Trump. And they made that list, and another disclosure for the first time in this book. It turns out just before the election, they shredded a bunch of documents related to Trump. So there's been news playing out now about this new revelation that there was maybe even the destruction of evidence here.
So at one point, I remember this very well, at one point in your book, you write that Nick Merrill, who was a longtime staffer for Hillary Clinton, approached you about the Weinstein story. And Weinstein, of course, was a major donor to her campaign. And Merrill allegedly told you that the story was, quote, a concern for us. What was he saying? And did Hillary Clinton in some way try to influence the story?
You know, Hillary Clinton was not, a hands-on assassin of the Weinstein story.
Right.
I think she had glancing knowledge of how serious it was, how much I had. I can't speak to her state of mind and what motivated her staff to raise concerns about my reporting on this major donor and friend of hers, and then to appear to attempt to back out of an interview that had been scheduled for a foreign policy book that I was working on. But I included in the book because it did feel relevant. It was a sign of the way in which this reporting had seeped into political circles of power, that people were becoming aware that I was working on it, even though I was trying to keep a lid on it, and the way in which each time it leaked further, it seemed like there were more and more negative repercussions for me, that the screws were turning and powerful allies of Harvey Weinstein's were beginning to find me radioactive.
Well, one of Weinstein's biggest tactics was to slander the women who accused him of sexual assault. I don't think it's unique to him, but that was a move. And examples of this include planting false stories about one woman being a prostitute, if I remember correctly, digging up photos of his accusers smiling while standing next to him, which was very common, and painting Rose McGowan in particular as, what would you say, unstable. And slut-shaming has always been a part of the response to sexual assault. And you thought that might have been changing, but then Matt Lauer's statement came out, and I was incredulous.
A lot of people have reacted that way to Matt Lauer's statement. And
did you?
Well, you know, I'd actually, before I talk about my reaction, point to the reaction of Brooke Nevels, the young journalist who accuses him of sexual assault.
He raped her in a hotel room in Sochi, Russia during the Olympics.
That's right. And you know, he leans heavily in his response on this idea, which was also deployed by Harvey Weinstein in his responses, that they had subsequent contacts. And her rendering of those contacts is that she was a junior employee dealing with the most powerful man at her company, and that she was intimidated when he said, come to my apartment, have a drink with me, and wanted to put him at ease, and therefore readily admits that there are communications between them that could seem enthusiastic after the fact. And that also some of those follow-up communications were not consensual, that she was forced to deal with him professionally and he demanded sexual favors during those encounters. He says this was an affair.
Consensual.
A consensual affair. And there was a concerted machine in motion trying to plant in the press this framing that it was an affair, which she describes as being nauseating because this is never how she described it to anyone. But here's the thing, David. The interpretation of the alleged crime doesn't depend on either of those accounts of events, because what she says, I think quite persuasively, and this is a story she has always told consistently, is that regardless of what happened before and after that night in Sochi and how he interpreted those other interactions, in that case, she was too drunk to consent, and she said no repeatedly, and he proceeded with a sex act that she had declined to perform, which was, as she tells the story, violent and injured her.
Journalism can be an awfully transactional occupation in the sense that the interplay between journalist and source has a purpose in a moment in time, and then both sides move on to other stories, to other moments, to other aspects of life. I get the sense that that's not the case with you and your sources, that the women that you dealt with so closely for, now it's now 2 years ago and more, how often do you speak to them and what's happened to them?
What David is referring to possibly is that I step out of a lot of meetings because I get a lot of calls from distraught sources at all hours.
You do.
I do. And you know, on one level, that's an honor. I was so grateful that these, particularly women in these stories, but whistleblowers of any type that speak in any of our stories, took that leap and did something in the public interest at personal risk. And the emotional tail of that commitment is long and honestly never ending. I mean, I think that decision and also the earlier traumas that were described in those stories will echo in these sources' lives as long as they live. So I do feel like part of my job is to, yes, make it clear to them I'm not their friend, I'm not their therapist, I am a lawyer, but I'm not their lawyer, and maintain journalistic arm's length, but also to be there to the extent that I can. And so I do, by and large, stay in touch with sources. And, you know, I have been hearing from them as this book comes out, and I've been immensely gratified to hear from, you know, people like Rose McGowan, who I've had my ups and downs and complications with during an extraordinarily high-stakes emotional process of reporting these stories, but who has been grateful to see the full expanse of what she went through as a target of this espionage operation exposed in this book. So these are not easy relationships, and they can be tense, they can be complicated, but I try to do right by sources when I can.
The book is Catch and Kill, by my friend and colleague, Ronan Farrow. Ronan, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
You can read Ronan Farrow's series, The Black Cube Chronicles, at newyorker.com. Now, for the record, take note that Matt Lauer denies having any sexual contact without consent, and AMI, the publisher of the National Enquirer, denies that documents pertaining to Donald Trump were shredded. Ronan's new book is called Catch and Kill. His interview with private investigator Igor Ostrovsky was excerpted from the Catch and Kill podcast with Ronan Farrow, and that's coming out soon from Pineapple Street Studios, so keep an eye out for that. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a moment, we'll talk impeachment with Nancy Pelosi. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Last week, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, sat down to talk with staff writer Jane Mayer at the New Yorker Festival and talk about timing. Last month, Pelosi began the impeachment inquiry on Donald Trump. She had resisted that move for a long time, to the point where some in her party were questioning her leadership. But with the revelations about Donald Trump's phone call to Ukraine, Pelosi declared, "He gave us no choice, and the rest just might be history." Now, Jane Mayer is a veteran of Washington politics and its scandals. She covered the Iran-Contra affair back in the day for the Wall Street Journal. And her book, Dark Money, is the crucial read to understand how money influences those in power. Here's Nancy Pelosi and Jane Mayer speaking at the New Yorker Festival on October 12th.
So thrilled to have you here.
My pleasure. I
understand that things have been really dull in Washington recently, and you have tons of free time on your hands to join us. So thank you very much for coming. We will talk about some of the issues I know you want to talk about, but I have to say, I think we kind of have to start with impeachment. When it was, if you could talk to us about the moment when you felt it was time to go ahead and authorize the inquiry into impeachment, what were you thinking at that point? How did it happen?
So you want to talk about that? Okay. Now, if that hadn't happened, what would we be talking about? I hope we'll have a chance to talk about how we are lowering the cost of prescription drugs by H.R. 3. And what we are doing right now, just to put this in context, we have been since we took the majority. So we're legislating, we're investigating, and we are litigating. Our investigations have led us to the courts, where we won 5 cases in the courts.
That's just got to be a record. It's got to be a record loss for any administration, 5 rulings in one day.
Hopefully they will recognize that. Because, but this is what this is about, just to, and I'll tell you the moment, but here's the thing. This is not anything to be gleeful about for our country. It's a very sad time when there is the thought that the President of the United States and the truth and the data and the facts show that the President of the United States has violated his oath of office. And why is that important? You'll recall on September 17, 1787, the Constitution was adopted that day. When Benjamin Franklin came out of Independence Hall onto the steps, they said to him, Dr. Franklin, do we have a monarchy or a republic? He said, a republic. If we can keep it. That republic is based on separation of power, co-equal branches of government, a check and balance on each other. Instead, we have a president who says, I can do whatever I want, and acts accordingly, and tries to undermine the powers of the legislative branch. So this isn't about any disregard for him. That's for the election. This is our democracy at risk. If we do not have a system of checks and balances, separation of power, we have a monarchy, a person who believes he can do whatever he wants, unaccountable. A republic, if we can save it, if we can keep it. Okay, so the moment.
So he declared that he could do anything he wanted under Article 2 a while back. And so what was it that changed? Was there some particular piece of information or a meeting you were in, a phone call with him? What actually happened?
Well, let me just say that for me, timing is everything. Timing is everything. So I said, when we get more facts, we will be ready. We will be ready. And when on September 17th, 2019, was the very day, boom, the explosion of the telephone call with the president and the president of Ukraine. That was a moment of revelation. This had clarity. And so, it was the following Tuesday. Now you want the moment.
It's the New Yorker. We like those details.
I'm not sure exactly what the moment was, but the assurance of it. The president called me in the morning. Don't tell anybody I'm telling you this, okay? And he wanted to talk about all the things he was doing to pass what he knows is not only a passion with me, but a dispassion with me, we're going to get it done, passing background checks legislation to end gun violence in our country. So he calls, so I want to tell you all the progress that we're making on the background checks and this or that. And I said, well, I would be interested to learn because I don't know of any progress. Oh, the Democrats and the Republicans are working together. I don't know what Democrats you're working with, but we have sent a bill over 200 days before that call. So then he decided to change the subject, which was probably the purpose of the call. About the call, it's perfect. I said, no, Mr. President, it's not perfect, it's wrong. It's wrong. And he said, there was no quid pro quo. I said, it doesn't need to be a quid pro quo, understand that. But there is a quid pro quo. And it's about the sequencing of events. A couple of days before, he withheld, and now he was probably going to grant, and that is a quid pro quo. However, even without that, just asking the head of state of a country to not dig up dirt, create dirt on a political opponent, that's not right. But his insistence that it was so right was just made it so imperative that we proceed. Now, I didn't tell him I was going to proceed. I said, actually, I was going to call you myself to tell you what we're observing here. And I'll be talking to my members today because they were just coming back on that Tuesday. And I said, you violated your oath of office, undermined our national security, and jeopardized the integrity of our elections, which is fundamental to our democracy. It wasn't a pleasant call.
Wow.
That's what happened.
I mean, and I don't want to dwell on this too much, but
oh, I think
could you tell whether... but yes, we do. Did you think he just didn't know it was wrong? I mean, or does he just not care? Can you tell?
As I have said, sometimes my five children will tell you, my daughter Alexandra, my husband Paul are here, will tell you that I do practice medicine on the side without benefit of diploma. But I haven't gone yet into psychiatry or anything like that. So I can't tell if he knows right from wrong or if he even cares. I just know he'd done wrong. But it is sad. It is sad. It's sad to see the people around him. What is with them? Henchmen. President's henchmen. I mean, that's just really what it's come down to. Because they probably have some level of objectivity, perhaps. So we'll see. We'll have an inquiry. Give them all the opportunity to introduce whatever exculpatory information he might have, any evidence that might prove something to the contrary, to be very fair, to not have it be further divisive for our country, but to try to begin a healing process for the Constitution, for the Republic, for our democracy.
I'm curious, looking ahead in this process, what you think...
She doesn't want to dwell on this.
If the House does impeach, do you have faith in the fairness of Mitch McConnell to hold a trial? Must he hold a trial, or can he basically sweep it under the rug with a quick up-and-down vote to acquit? I'm curious what you expect and think that the Constitution demands there.
Well, let me just say that anybody who names himself with great pride the Grim Reaper, I don't have a lot of faith in doing the right thing as we go forward. Here's our thing. The courage of the House to honor its oath of office to protect and to defend the Constitution of the United States is not affected by the cowardice of the Senate to look the other way and not honor their oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. So when they said, they're supposedly writing me a letter saying, don't bother going down this path because we're not going to do anything about it. Oh, really? I'm so glad you wrote to me. that won't have anything to do with it. But require this, that as we go forward prayerfully, that we do so strategically in a way that is ironclad. Should we go down this path? That decision has not been made. I don't want to give that impression. Should we go down that path? If we should go down that path, that it would be written so focused, indisputable in terms of where we are, so that if the Senate decides that they have better things to do that day, that the public will recognize that they have abandoned their oath of office. And so, what are their options? They could say they acquit. So they acquit. He's impeached forever if we go down that path. You are impeached forever should we go down that path, if we should go down that path. But it cannot go unaddressed, because any other president might come along and decide he or she can just do whatever they feel like doing.
Well, I mean, I often wonder, and I'm curious what you think about, why the Republicans are so in line with him. I get the feeling from my own reporting that they don't necessarily like Trump. And in fact, there was a quote recently from Mike Murphy, a Republican, you know, campaign consultant, who said if impeachment was a blind vote, 30 Republican senators would vote against him.
How courageous of them.
How courageous. Well, what are they so afraid of?
Let me just say about this, because people ask me all this all the time, about when are the Republicans going to bolt him? Forget that. That's not the case. They wish he wouldn't tweet, but that's about as far as the criticism goes. Here's the thing. Donald Trump is their guy. There is nothing that he has put out there that they haven't been for longer and worse. Name any subject. Denial on climate, women's right to choose, gun safety, respect for immigrants. Name any subject, fairness in our economy and the rest. They've been there longer. So he's their guy. He'd be like me in college with John F. Kennedy. Whatever that's it.
Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House of Representatives, talking with The New Yorker's Jane Mayer. Their conversation continues in just a moment on The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you're just joining us today, we're going to return now to Jane Mayer's conversation with Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. She's been serving in Congress for more than 30 years, representing a district in San Francisco, and she's led the House Democrats since 2003. As Speaker, Pelosi is overseeing the impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump, and her actions will have consequences that are truly impossible to calculate. Nancy Pelosi spoke with the New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer on October 12th. At the New Yorker Festival.
People have noticed that when it comes to the nicknames he comes up with for people, the ones he's got for you are a little bit like more careful. He says, you know, Nervous Nancy and things like that. And given his propensity to project, I wonder if maybe you make him a little nervous.
Well, I do believe, Jane, that everything he says is a projection of himself. When he calls me Nervous Nancy, I know he's very nervous. When he calls Adam Schiff this or that, this one, that, I think, he's projecting. He knows the argument that can be made against him. At least I think he should or does. For example, this ridiculous thing that he's doing about Joe Biden, his kids are so financially invested. So before you can say that about me, I'm going to make it up about you. I think maybe he doesn't have a name for me, or is because he knows I couldn't care less. Any knock from him is a boost to me.
Well, I almost wondered if it was that you use that famous mother of five voice on him. and he hasn't had many peers who are female. Do you think maybe it rattles him a little bit to have a woman of power who sounds like his mom?
He never mentions his mother. Have you ever heard that? I heard him once say, my mother said I like trucks. That was the only reference I ever heard him make. But you know what? Forget about him. It's only 13 months, fewer than 13 months until the election. We've got to be talking about a wonderful future for our country. All these beautiful candidates up there, I'm so proud of all of them, showing their why. Why they think they should be president. What they care about and know about, be it climate, education, social justice, strategically how they think they can encourage people to work with them to get things done.
Do you worry at all about the party becoming and going too far left in the coming presidential election? I know that you are not a fan of Medicare for All, and at least a couple of the front-running candidates are. There's also been talk of decriminalizing the borders and abolishing ICE. Are you worried about this?
Well, let me just say on the subject of Medicare for All, what I have said is put it all on the table and let's just see where we get the best benefits at the lowest cost for health care for all Americans. What that path is a matter of discussion. And I think that our candidates are having a good discussion about that out there. I myself believe that the path is to strengthen the Affordable Care Act as we go forward. Not, some people get kind of like a little taken aback when they say we're going to take away your private insurance, which is something that, that works for them. But it's a matter of discussion. Let me just say this. November matters. There are some who belong to a November doesn't matter club, and so it's whatever works in the primary. Now, I am a left-wing San Francisco liberal. So I can say this to them. You know all that stuff you're talking about? I have those signs in my basement from 30 years ago. I have been there, done that. I was chair of the California Democratic Party. Very, very, very progressive. But in terms of winning the Electoral College, I think we have so much common ground with the public, so much common ground on America's working families, climate, issues that are winning issues across the board. We don't have to lead with our differences. Let's lead with what we have in common and then try to persuade people to our other point of view. Because, and you can tell people I said this, what has happened to our country in the last almost two and a half years, whatever it is, we can repair. It's a decision we must make to repair. We can heal some naturally, but we must proactively repair. Another term, irreparable. The courts and the rest. We must win the presidential election. And we must win the presidential election.
What is your greatest fear about a second Trump term?
You don't want me to tell you. Well, it just can't happen. I mean, who thought it would happen now? But that's why we have to, shall we say, curb some of our enthusiasm. Not that we don't want them, it's just about you have to win in order to get anything done. So let's win, baby. And then get done what really works for the American people. And how that, what works in Michigan, for example, about helping for our children, economic security for America's working families, that works in San Francisco. What works in San Francisco might not work in Michigan. So let's go with the Michigan plan, because that's where we have to win the Electoral College.
Is it still harder, do you think, for a woman to be elected president?
I certainly hope not. Frankly, I never thought about running for Congress. And the people asked me to run, one person who was the incumbent asked me to run. So, okay, I'll do that. Now, I always thought that the American people would elect a woman president of the United States well before the marble-ceilinged Congress of the United States would ever enable a woman to get in the pecking order to be in the leadership, and certainly the Speaker of the House of Representatives. But we did. And when I get introduced frequently now, they'll say, the highest ranking woman in the history of the United States, like I'm supposed to smile. And I'm like heartbroken. I wish that were not true. I wish that we had a woman president of the United States right now because of how great she would have been, but also for what it would have spared the country in terms of our Constitution, our response, and the rest. So I think the country is ready for one. It's just a matter of time. It's inevitable, and to some people, it's inconceivable. But as with everything we do, we shorten the distance between inevitable to us and inconceivable to them. I think the American people, though, are ready.
You do. Well, you know,
it isn't without its obstacles. Don't get me nothing is without its obstacles. And by the way, don't ever assume that it's a natural thing that the incumbent might not get reelected. That's why we have to, again, make a decision to win. And when you make a decision to win, you make every decision in favor of winning.
I know you've been quite critical of the press, the mainstream media, nothing like the way the president talks about it, but I've seen that you've thought that we have, in some ways, I don't know if we've been used or if we give too much attention to him, or what is it you think we've done wrong, and what should we be doing differently?
Well, I'm not saying you've done, I'm just making an observation that I think in many respects the press have been enablers for the Trump agenda. I just do. But on a daily basis, he's the master of diversion. He throws something, and for 24 hours we hear that he did this, that, or the other thing, without paying really attention to what else is going on. Now, maybe that's what the market wants, and that's what is being catered to. I don't know.
So you think we should ignore the tweets more, basically?
No, I mean, I think that you should talk about what else is going on. You know, I really do. I think there are other things that are going on aside from what he does 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's all. Because it's deadly serious for our country. He has dumbed down the discussion of what public policy is about. The Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, freedom of speech and the rest. It's the tactic of an autocrat to undermine the press and then to dominate the news. So no matter what's happening, you're talking about me. Even if it's terrible, you're talking about me. You're not talking about what they're doing. That might be good for the country. He is textbook in that regard. But I've never spoken this much about him. I never have. Well, in fact, one of the things that I like the most that I saw this weekend was somebody, Mickey Hart, you know, Grateful Dead. I'm a Grateful Dead fan. He sent me this, meme, I guess it is. It's me, and I'm saying, Donald, you used to own a casino. You know the house always wins.
The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She spoke with Jane Mayer at the New Yorker Festival on October 12th. Jane has been a staff writer at the magazine since 1995, and you can read everything she's written for us at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This week's episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman and David Ohana of the New Yorker Festival, along with Noriko Akabe and Danny Bonner. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.